This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Know-How is brought to you by CashFly.
This episode of Know-How is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you fresh, high-quality ingredients to cook delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. Today on Know-How,
best of 2016.
It's a Twitch show where we have no fade from our opening vid because that's how we roll. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire.
And I'm Brian Burnett.
And for the next however many minutes it takes, we're going to be taking you through some of our favorite moments of 2016. Now, Brian.
Padre.
You've been co-hosting the show for, what, is it the, we're going into the third year now, right?
Is this third year now?
It's crazy.
It's gone by really fast, if that's the case.
We're episode 272.
Well, things really started to accelerate when we did two episodes a week.
Yes.
Which gave us more opportunities to screw up, basically.
Which we loved, because, you know, Know-How, we figured this out a long time ago. Know-How is kind of like a bro show.
It's a bro show.
We do some fun projects, but mostly it's... We crack on each other because that's what we do.
That's we like to work on tech and make fun of each other.
Indeed.
That's about it.
So what we want to do is we want to show you some of our favorite moments of 2016. We're going to take you some of our best projects through some of our most, well, endearing moments and really give you the best of the best of the best of 2016. So without further ado, hey, press that magic button.
This is TWiT.
Welcome to Know-How! It's the Twitch show where we build, bend, break, and upgrade. What we wanted to do today is we wanted to answer some of the questions that people have been having about networking.
You'll know how to choose between a Chromebook or a Cloudbook.
This is a gimbal that you would buy for something like a quadcopter, right? This is actually really inexpensive. That's not supposed to be happening.
Get it away from the table.
Okay.
So, you want a quadcopter that doesn't need to be registered with the FAA? Well, I think we can help you with that.
To start your Raspberry Pi security cam project, all you're going to need is a Raspberry Pi.
So what we have in front of us is a wireless camera system.
Okay.
We are going to be dealing with dry ice. Super simple circuit.
And solder.
Brian, you actually got to take a look at an electric vehicle that was a bit more practical.
Yes, a bit more practical, a little bit less dangerous. You know, there's not a lot of blades spinning around on it. I recently got to go down to Brisbane, just south of San Francisco, where they are making an electric bicycle. I want to say it's a motorbike. So it's not quite a electric motorcycle, and it's not quite an electric bicycle. It's kind of a hybrid in between.
So, okay, how do you define each of that? What makes an electric bike? What makes an electric motorcycle? And then what does it mean to fall in between?
So, what would make an electric motorcycle would be something like the Zero DS that we reviewed on Before You Buy.
That's where, like 3 years ago.
Yeah. That was, like 3 years ago, where it was about $15,000, mm-hmm. had a huge battery, but you had pegs. You know, everything about it was a motorcycle. You could ride it on the street. You had to register it. You have to have a license to ride it. An electric bicycle would be something a lot lighter, smaller size. You don't have to register it. Top speed of 20 miles per hour, because I think once you do over that, you have to have it registered and stuff.
Got it.
And so what Bolt Motorbikes has done is they've built an electric motorbike that has pedals. So it has the feel of a bicycle, but the dynamics of, like, it has a throttle and a disc front brake and motorcycle tires. And the whole package weighs about 140 pounds.
I don't get it. Why make that hybrid? Why not just go with one or the other?
So this is basically like the killer errand runner machine for like a urban environment. So if you want to go up hills, it's powerful enough to go up hills, but it's easy enough to ride. If you've ever ridden a bicycle, you could hop on it. And the range is about I think between 35 to 20 miles per hour, or 20 miles, depending on how you ride it. And it has bicycle pedals on it, so you can pedal it like a bike. And that also allows it to not be, you have to register it or have a license for it.
Ah, okay. Okay, I think actually you've got some B-roll, so we could take a look at what it actually looks like. And then maybe you can explain what it is that we're seeing.
Okay, so if you roll the B-roll, me and Cara, one of our engineers, went down to check out where they manufacture these.
It looks like an old Indian.
Well, so it's based off something called, a Pug or something.
A Pug?
I don't know. It's like a moped. It's basically a moped. So we went down to Brisbane where they're constructing these, and Bolt was actually an Indiegogo that they got funded through that, and it's really cool to see the production process of everything.
But, so these are all handcrafted?
These are all handcrafted. Nathan, the owner and creator of the company, actually has his PhD in mechanical engineering, and he had started at working at Zero, and then he had helped them increase their production. So they're not cranking out bikes every day, but they're getting to the point where they can build two or three bikes in a day or two. And they have this kind of cafe racer retro style to them. And that is really conducive for keeping it light. I think one of my favorite things about riding
it... It looks fun.
It was super fun. So the electric motor is about the same... I would put it, if you were going to compare it to like a gas bike, it would be somewhere around 100 cc's.
Really?
Yeah. That's so
What's the range? Like how far can you get if you were riding like you're riding right now?
So if you're riding like this, I would say probably 20, 25 miles.
That's not bad.
And this thing powers up hills and stuff like that.
Does it do regen braking?
It does. So the front, you have a disc brake, which is really nice. It worked really well. And then the rear is actually the regen braking, which is the left lever on there. And so when you squeeze that, it starts the regenerative process. And the harder you squeeze it, the more it'll start braking. And it's a lot smoother than some of the other regenerative braking systems.
So it doesn't want to throw you over the handlebars.
Yeah, no. It's very subtle and controllable. Like,
how much does this thing weigh? I mean, I'm thinking, is this something like I could put into the back of my car?
Yes. It's they were picking them up. I mean, it's 140 pounds, so it's still pretty heavy.
But like, maybe it could be a lot heavy. I'm gathering most of that is the battery.
Right. And you can, so one of the cool features they have is that the battery system is modular, and what you do is you flip a tab and you pull back a lever and it detaches the batteries from the hookup, and then you can basically pull them out like a little briefcase, and each battery weighs about 15 pounds.
That's cool.
So, and I was thinking that it was going to be kind of top heavy because the batteries are basically where a gas tank would be, and there's not, the only thing below it is basically the electric motor. But it wasn't top heavy at all, and I think because it's so light, it steers like a bicycle, but you've got the throttle like a motorcycle, and so it's very like controllable.
Does it have that typical electric vehicle low end torque where it just like wants to snap your spine if you just dig it?
No, it doesn't. What they've done is they programmed it so you just get like a linear, you know, torque band off of the off the line.
That's a safety thing, really. Because I mean,
it's definitely a safety.
If you take a typical electric motor that can power something like this, 100 cc equivalent, you would spin the back tire if you just want throttle up.
Well, and so Nathan pointed out, he said, you know, you can do a wheelie on it. Actually, you hold in the regenerative braking lever and then you just floor it. Considering I see, I couldn't do that. That's Nathan, the guy, the owner of the company.
See, I wouldn't want that coming over the top of me.
That's called a stoppie. He, not only is he like really passionate about bikes, but he's super knowledgeable. So, we had a lot of fun going down there. I'm not going to say it's without problem because it's $5,475.
Okay. That's a lot, but that's actually not.
Right, you have to think in the realm of like electric vehicles. That's actually not that bad, considering like a full electric motorcycle is going to cost you over $12,000.
Right,
you may be able to find an electric bicycle for a little bit less than that, but they've really put a lot of forethought into how they manage the batteries, and you can lock it up like you would a normal bike. And what else was there about it it was kind of a neat feature to unlock the bike. One of the co-founders' fathers was actually the guy who invented the Bop It. And so when you the start-on process is you like you turn on the bike, and then to unlock it, you can customize what you do to
start it, pull it, pop
so
it.
You turn the throttle, you tap the brake, you press the button, and then it'll come on. Or you can unlock it with your phone. So
that's a little Mad Max. Yeah, left, left, right, right, left, right, turn, twist.
Yeah, exactly. Pop it, twist it, pull it. So they came on the screensavers. If you want to find out some more information or watch that segment that we did with Leo, but I think he was convinced to maybe get one for the studio, which I would be up for.
Well, I mean, consider this. That's the same price as a loaded Segway.
Yes.
And you'll get further and faster on this than you will on a Segway.
Right, and that's why I think this is something for if you live in an urban city, basically San Francisco. If you're somewhere like San Francisco where there's hills and you know there's not a lot of not everybody has a garage,
right?
The best way to get around the city is on a bicycle, and this kind of treads the line where you can like go up hills on it. You can don't have to register it, and like any other electric vehicle, the initial cost is all the battery stuff,
right?
But you don't. The only things you'll ever have to do is clean the chain, you know, change the brake pads. There's no oil. There's no, like, engine tuning or anything like that.
It's always interesting. Whenever a technology like this comes out, there's that moment of, okay, this is cool. This would be fun. And then the questions of, but what if I did this? And what if I was in this situation? And what if this
is happened? It practical for me?
Is it practical? And I think, you know, for me, the Segway is really like that. I like riding the Segway. Mm-hmm. It's a fun vehicle to drive. It's actually very useful. I like that little Ninebot I found at CES because I like the robot mode.
Mm-hmm.
But then the question is, is that where I'm going to spend $1,000?
Right.
And like, will it end up sitting in my garage?
Yeah. So if you were someone who had a choice between a Segway and this, like, what would you do?
I'd probably go with this.
That's what my choice was, too. Yeah. And you can have a passenger on it, too.
Well, so. I mean, I think I am a passenger. So maybe not me. You could have a passenger. Yeah. I think I would side seat myself.
Well, you know, I could get, like, a little sidecar or something for my dog. And he can ride around with me.
Actually, he wouldn't need it. You just put him in a backpack, the little corgi backpack.
Yeah.
Like, aerodynamic.
So, you want a quadcopter that doesn't need to be registered with the FAA, but still has the zip and kick of our know-how 250? Well, I think we can help you with that. Our parts list looks like the build of any of our previous quadcopters, just smaller. 4 motors and props, 4 electronic speed controllers, a frame, flight controller and receiver, power system, and a first-person view camera and transmitter. Remember that the number one focus of this build is weight. We need the craft, complete with FPV and battery, to weigh less than 250 grams, the cutoff for FAA registration. Our build, as parted, will be under 250 grams, but the more weight that we shave during the build, the better our performance and battery life. Let's start by assembling the frame. The Diatone Blade Series 150mm frame comes with a top and bottom plate, 4 arms, 4 risers, a power distribution and battery eliminator board, and all the screws and spacers you need. Find the plate that has 3 large centerline cutouts on each end. Set it aside. That is the top half of the frame. Now place 1 arm on each of the 4 arm mounts. The 4 screw edge of each arm is the motor mount and goes to the outside. And you want the outer edge of each arm to be parallel to the frame. Notice that the frame and arms give you several options for mounting that allow the arm to be pulled in up to 5mm on each side. You can choose your own position, but I prefer to have my arms at the furthest position in order to give my props as much clearance as possible. Once you're satisfied that your arms are in the right position, it's time to bolt them to the frame. Take out 8 of the supplied bolts, 4 nuts, and 4 aluminum risers. Dab a little Loctite Blue on one bolt, insert it into the eye of one arm, and align the arm with the underside of the bottom plate. Then use a nut to loosely fasten the bolt in place. Take another bolt, dab it in Loctite Blue, and insert it so that the arm is bolted in place as far from centerline as possible. Tighten down a riser on the bolt, then tighten the nut on the first bolt. Repeat the process for the other 3 arms. You should now have an assembled frame without the top plate. Leave that off for now because we're going to need to work inside the frame. It's time to mount the motors. You should have 2 motors with clockwise thread and 2 motors with counterclockwise. Spinner colors can vary, so the best way to know which motor is which is to hold the spinner, then gently attempt to rotate the motor. The rotation that loosens the spinner is the opposite of the needed rotation for that motor. In other words, if I hold the spinner and a clockwise rotation of the motor loosens that spinner, then the thread is designed to be on a counterclockwise rotating motor.
This might sound like a trivial and confusing step, but it's important. The right thread on a motor will actually tighten a loose prop rather than letting it spin away. The forward left arm, number one, gets a clockwise motor. The forward right arm, number two, gets a counterclockwise motor. The rear right arm, number three, gets a clockwise motor. And the rear left arm, number four, gets a counterclockwise motor. Align the motor so that the wiring harness points towards the center line of the craft. Using the M2 5mm bolts included in the motor packages, secure each motor to its arm along with a dab of Loctite Blue. With the motors mounted, we can turn our attention to the electrical and flight control systems. Now, we deliberately didn't include a flight controller for the build because we wanted you to choose your own. My personal preference would be for a Flip 32 racing controller, but it uses PPM input, and many radio systems don't support that. So instead, I'm mocking up the build with a Mini KK. This is going to be an uncommon electrical build-out because we're going to get really aggressive with removing as much weight as possible. This means a minimum of wire in the build and no bullet connectors. This type of build is more difficult to service and maintain, but the weight savings mean more performance or flight time. One of the weight-saving measures we took during the purchasing portion of the project was to buy 20-amp Little B ESCs that don't include battery eliminator circuits. This saved us 5 grams per ESC, but it also means that we'll need another way to power the avionics. Thankfully, our power distribution board has an integrated BEC. Take the Ditone power distribution board and break it out of its PCB molding. Down one side of the board, you'll see all the positive soldering pads, and down the other are the negative. This is where the battery connector and ESCs will be soldered. In the middle of the board are two pairs of pads marked for 5 volts. These will connect to our flight controller and receiver, giving the power that would normally come from BEC-equipped ESCs. Using the included nylon screws, put 4 of them through the bottom of the frame. Rotate the board so that the 5-volt pads are forward and aft. The power distribution board was designed to work flat against the frame, but if you happen to have 4 paper washers, you could use them to slightly space the board from the frame and give yourself a little extra short protection. Use 4 nylon spacers to secure the power distribution board to the frame. Now comes the fun part. And by fun, I mean the part where I could possibly destroy some of my gear. We need to solder the motor leads to the ESCs and the ESC power leads to the power distribution boards, and we need to do it all with as little extra wire as possible. Run the motor leads down through the arm, then sandwich them between the arm and an ESC. We're going to solder the motor leads directly to the ESCs. Now, if you were adventurous, the proper way to do this would be to cut away the heat shrink on an ESC and attach the leads directly to the pads. But if you're not sure of your soldering skills, an easier way to do it is to cut and solder the leads together. No matter how you do it, try to remove as much wire as possible. It's okay to leave yourself a service length for future repairs, but you don't want so much that it triples back on itself. When you're absolutely certain of the lengths that you want, cut, strip, and tin each of the lead ends. Slip a length of heat shrink over each set of wires and then solder the leads together and insulate. Pull the leads back up to the top of the arm, then use a small zip tie to hold both the ESC and the wires to the arm. Once all 4 of your motors are connected to their ESCs, we need to solder the ESC power leads and the battery connector to the power distribution board. Run the ESC power leads up through each arm, then cut them with a little slack for future servicing. Preload each of the pads with a dollop of solder, then strip, tin, and solder your 20-gauge silicone JST battery connector to the rearmost pads. Red for positive, black for negative. Now is a good time to break out your multimeter and test for shorts, making sure that there is no path between the positive and negative pads. If there are no shorts, connect the JST connector to a battery, then use the multitester to make sure that you're getting full power through the positive and negative full power pads, and 5 volts through the 5-volt pads. Repeat the process for each pair of ESC power leads. If the right voltage is flowing for all pads, solder the ESC power leads to the pads on either side of the power distribution board. That does it for this segment of Project Socket FAA. If you followed along, you should now have a frame with 4 motors and 4 ESCs connected to a power distribution board. Next week, we're going to install and power our avionics, check motor rotation, and get her ready for her maiden flight.
I think the name of the project was pretty subtle.
Oh, yeah, very subtle. Yeah, I don't think anyone would pick up on that.
No, not whatsoever. A few other things I do want to mention is we got very close. What you saw on that last shot was that's everything, absolutely everything. It was less than 240 grams.
That's pretty good.
In fact, let's do a weigh right now. If you go to the overhead So what we're going to do is so everything is jumbled, of course. Here's the frame with the top piece. Here's the smaller of the two batteries. Here are four props because we got to have those on there. Here's the flight controller, the FPV. Make sure everything stays on. Can't cheat here. The FPV transmitter.
Looks like a mess.
One. It is a mess. This and all the wiring and the receiver. So all together, that comes up to 206 grams.
Oh, you still got some headroom.
I got some headroom. But that's why, this is a small, small battery. This is the 500 milliamp hour.
What if we increase it?
It would add about 30 grams. So go to a 1,000. So double the power, double the amount of flight time.
Let's do both batteries.
We almost could. Well, actually, what I'd like to do is, at this weight, at 206 grams, I can still put a GoPro session.
Oh, I see. So you
can
record
really
your footage.
Nice,
yeah.
High definition video. Mm-hmm. That's probably what I'm going to do. And I'm going to shave a few things. Like, for example, this receiver, I'm going to take it out of the case. That's going to save me 3 or 4 grams.
Okay.
I'm going to be removing the metal contacts off the flight controller. That's going to pull off another 3 or 4 grams. let's just do this. People are going to wonder why we did all that extra work of shaving the wires. And that's because this is what I took off. So this, in this bag, this is all the stuff that was removed that we otherwise would have used. So in a regular build, we would have used this much wire. We would have used these banana connectors. Mm-hmm. This is how much it adds. So that's 24, 25 grams worth of stuff. That's 10% of the total allowable build weight just by shaving off those wires. And
it adds up quick.
It does add up quick. Look at this. This one, mm-hmm. This is done so that these are soldered directly onto the ESC. So you can notice there's very little excess wire on that one. Versus these, they're kind of bundled up. You see that?
Right.
So if you do have the skill and if you are steady enough with the soldering iron, do this because that's actually going to get you another 6 grams back.
Did that take some practice for you?
No.
Or no?
Actually, the real reason. I wanted to do it this way because this is the easier way to do it. Just bind them together and then heat shrink them.
Ah, yeah.
But I accidentally cut too short on one of them.
Oh, no.
So I'm like, I just soldered directly to the ESC.
Yeah, no problem.
Let me start by saying that if this had been the netbook, the netbook would have survived back then.
Back then, yeah.
But it is still a low-powered Windows PC.
Right. Battery life, though.
Battery life is fantastic.
Pro.
I mean, seriously, you can stretch this to 15 hours easy. If all you were doing was surfing the web, and if you allowed the screen to go to half brightness, and if you were connected via Wi-Fi, you would get 15 hours out of this. So in that sense, it is a good second or third computer. But the question becomes, is it worth the $200, $250? And that all depends on one thing. If you're going to use Office, because if you are going to use Office, that subscription is going to run you between $79 and $100.
Mm-hmm.
So that's half the price of a notebook. So basically, if you were going to buy Office anyways, you get a notebook for $100.
Which I think you just spelled out the biggest difference between these two machines is if you are in the Google ecosystem,
right.
It makes sense to go with the Chromebook. If you are someone who uses Office all the time, $250 for a laptop that you would have almost 15 hours of battery life for? That makes sense.
It does make sense. And you know, looking at the two devices, you can see that this is actually a pretty good value machine. That's one of the things I liked about this Chromebook. You do notice that they skimped on a few things. The material of the construction's not quite as good as you get on a higher end. The screen doesn't have great viewing angles.
No.
But, you know, it does work. It does work as a tablet. It does work as a notebook. It does work as a cloud book. For that much money, it's actually very, very attractive.
Right.
For this, there are a few things that they did absolutely right. I am convinced that they got the keyboard and the mouse for this CloudBook off of like the Acer S7, one of their higher-end models.
Which makes a big difference.
It makes a huge difference. I am so accustomed to cheap notebooks just having that cheap keyboard feel. This keyboard actually feels really nice. And this trackpad is responsive. It's not that like it feels like it's on a spring. It's very inaccurate.
Yeah.
But, you know, of course, there's the audio. They should have just ignored the speakers altogether. Just take the speakers out.
Well, that's kind of the same thing with the PC monitors. They put speakers and monitors just because.
Don't do it.
Yeah.
Stop. You know, in fact, they could probably save 99 cents taking each speaker out, put a $2 set of headphones inside the box, and it would sound so much better than this.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing about this is, you know, it actually is pretty light. This is a 3.5-pound notebook. If I had someone who I knew was either going to destroy their notebooks with regularity, or yes. if I knew that all they really did was check email and write
or they had to write papers, yeah.
This,
that's why I feel like these are
pretty good.
Perfect kind of college. Like, I wish I had this when I was going to school kind of thing.
Yeah.
My biggest disappointment, I mean, I haven't played with this that much, is that no touch screen, which I would really like to see with a Windows 10 machine.
A touch screen on this would add something like $50 to the price. So instead of a $250 device, it's now a $300 device. And something else. Once you add a touch screen, people start expecting a bit more performance from it.
Well, you'll have to bump up the performance. You might even need a better integrated graphics. Yeah. But then you wouldn't be seeing the 14 hours of battery life.
And
either.
Then you wouldn't be seeing this price point. Because if you upgrade the touchscreen, then you should probably upgrade the screen itself to a better screen, like an IPS screen. If you're going to upgrade that, then you probably need to bump it up to 4 gigabytes of memory. You should probably use a discrete graphics card.
Yep.
And you're probably also going to want a bigger SSD than 64 gigabytes.
And you're not going to get that for under $300.
No, now we're at $500.
That's why I like we're doing this comparison, because both these machines are basically distilled versions of compromise.
Yes, but I will say this. I will say that this Windows 10 box compromises more than the Chromebook.
I would agree.
Using a Pixel and using this, it feels the same.
Right.
Maybe the screen's not as sharp. Maybe it's not as snappy, but it's pretty dang close. Using the Cloudbook and using my Acer S7, you obviously feel that, there's a huge difference in quality between the two.
That's true.
Yeah. So what takeaways can we give to the audience? So if they're considering a Cloudbook or a Chromebook, if they're looking at the Windows ecosystem or the Google ecosystem, what would your advice be?
All right. If you're like me and you're pretty much into the Google ecosystem because of work, I mean, that's what we use here, so I'm very integrated in that. I'd say definitely get a Chromebook. If you are someone who doesn't have Wi-Fi where you go when you would be using these, probably not your best bet. But if you're someone who is going to be going to school, be going to coffee shops, be going to work, and you want something that's durable, something you're going to throw in your backpack, and you also want a touchscreen, and it works really well. The touchscreen works well. The disappointment I have with Google Chrome as the OS is Chrome isn't really optimized for touch.
That's right.
So when you're trying to thumb through browsers and stuff browser tabs and things like that.
Chrome is horrible with touch.
Which is I wanted to see the Edge browser on here, Windows 10 style. But if you're someone who's going to school, you want to throw this in your backpack, and you don't need a lot of storage space because you're not going to be putting photos on this. You're not going to be, editing video on this. You just want something to type up your papers and, watch YouTube on it. This is the one to get.
I would totally go with that. I think you hit all the right points. Do you have Wi-Fi connectivity? Are you going to be doing a lot of things that involve the cloud and not being on device? And I think I can follow those same guidelines when I talk about the Cloudbook. So the nice thing about this Cloudbook is it is low cost, but it is a Windows 10 experience. So if you use this and then you move to a Windows 10 desktop, it will feel the same.
Right.
The other nice thing is it is Windows 10. So if you've got software that you want to run in Windows, it will work on this. It will not work on the Chromebook. So, for example, I installed Visual Studio on this, and I use this as a coding machine.
Nice.
It was fine for that.
Yeah,
I use this to program my Raspberry Pis. It was fine for that.
Yeah.
So that part is, I like that. But not everyone wants that or needs that.
Yeah.
The other thing to remember about this is, yes, you do get the 1 terabyte of online storage with OneDrive. And yes, you do get Microsoft Office. But this is a capable notebook even if you're completely disconnected from the internet. It's not as if you lose functionality when you don't have connectivity. It just means you don't have access to all your online storage.
It's true. But I'd say for myself, there's very few occasions where I am without a Wi-Fi hotspot.
That's true.
That's my life right now.
That's true. I will also note that this actually is cheaper than that. Not by much, but a tiny bit. So I think it's clear. If you are looking for a computer for non-computer people who just want to be able to do their things on the internet, the Chromebook is actually spectacular for that.
True.
If you've got a computer for someone who is a little bit computer savvy, I actually think the Cloudbook would work a little bit better.
I agree with that.
Okay.
As much as I'd hate to say it, but yes, you're right.
Brian,
Yeah.
What I want to do, though, is I want to see the inner workings of a Raspberry security camera. I want to see how you put it together, and I want to see how it works. Mm-hmm. You think we could do that?
Yeah, I think so. Just a heads up, Burke figured it out by the end of it. So you might want to do a better job disguising your webcam, but... you know, it worked pretty good for a couple weeks.
It did. It was up there. That wasn't the best surveillance job I've seen, but yeah, okay.
Well, you know. Yeah. But yeah, if you want to know how to put it together, watch this video.
So to start your Raspberry Pi security cam project, all you're going to need is a Raspberry Pi. I'm using a Model B Revision 2 with 512 megabytes of RAM, a micro SD card, 8 gigabytes or higher, a webcam. I'm using a Logitech HD webcam, C520, and a USB that you can use for external power. Now, as far as setting up your Raspberry Pi for the first boot, downloading the OS, I'm going to be using Raspbian, Jesse, the light version, which means it doesn't have a GUI. I'm going to be running the security cam program, and I don't really need to have an interface OS, so I'm downloading the light version. Once you have extracted the image from the zip file, you can use WinDisk Imager to write to the SD card. It's going a lot quicker than it does in real life through the magic of editing, but it doesn't take too long. Take your SD card, plug it into the Raspberry Pi, plug in all your other accessories, keyboard, mouse, webcam, Ethernet, and finally power. Now you're going to be first greeted with a Raspberry Pi login. All default login information for Raspberry Pi is username Pi, password Raspberry. Once you've done that, one of the first commands you're going to want to run is ifconfig. That's going to bring up the IP address that your Pi is using on your local network. In my case, it's 10.140.8.79. That's the IP that we're going to need for logging into the Pi through SSH, which is the next step that we need to take by typing in raspi sudo raspi dash config. That'll bring you to the Raspberry Pi configuration tool menu. Go into advanced settings, go down to SSH, and turn on SSH. This way you'll be able to log in remotely from your PC to your Raspberry, which is handy if you either don't have a monitor or if you're going to be setting up this security cam in a more remote place and you want to be able to get to it over your network. Now, if you're on Windows like me, you'll download PuTTY, which is a free program for using SSH connections. And in this case, for the host name, all you'll do is type in the IP address that you got earlier on port 22. And again, in my case, it's 10.140.8.79. And click connect. Once you do, you'll be greeted with the login as, and like before, Pi with the password Raspberry. And the first thing you're going to want to do is, now that you have this nice bigger screen to play with, you can now do sudo apt-get update. What this will do is fetch all the updates that you need for getting your Raspberry Pi set up. This will take about a half an hour, so sit back, relax for a little while, and then once it's done doing the update, you can do sudo apt-get upgrade, and that'll make sure that everything's fully upgraded and up to date. So the next command you're going to want to do is the actual install for the motion software, which is sudo apt-get install motion. Hit enter, hit Y for yes, and then it will start downloading and installing motion onto our Raspberry Pi. And this is the software we need for the security cam. Another handy command that you can do is lsusb, and that will list the devices currently hooked up to your Raspberry Pi via USB. So in my case, you can see the Logitech HD webcam C510 on the list. And if you're having trouble detecting your webcam, run this command just to double check if the Raspberry Pi is seeing it. The next command you're going to want to run is sudo nano /etc/motion/motion.conf. Here's where you can set all the different options for your security cam software. And there's a lot of granular little settings that you can do. But off the bat, if you just want to get this project started, there's just a couple that you kind of have to fiddle with. Now, because I'm running on the Raspberry Pi 2, I can change the frame rate to 30. If I was on the Raspberry Pi 1, max frame rate I was able to get was 15. You can also set a user password for logging into the software, change the contrast, the saturation on the camera. You can set different areas of motion detection and things like that. You can set where recordings of videos will go, where photos will be saved to. If you're like me and you just want to get this project up and running and not necessarily bog down your system right off the bat and just make sure it's working right, you're going to want to disable image output photos just off the bat to make sure everything's working right, because I had issues where the Raspberry Pi was saving photos and saving video and crashing. I would suggest turning off output photos or output underscore pictures, turn off the FFmpeg output movies. And these options you can change later depending on what you want to do. Now, by default, the stream port is 8081. That'll come in handy later when we're looking for the camera scene. And then you can change the maximum frame rate for the stream. So that's what you'll be seeing when you go to the IP address to 30 if you're using the Raspberry Pi 2, which worked fine for me. If you want to access your Raspberry Pi from something outside, you'll want to turn the stream localhost off. And that's it. Hit Control X to exit and Y to save your work and enter, and then you'll be brought back to the main terminal page. Now you can do, the next step you'll want to do is to make the motion software start up with boot. So in case your Raspberry Pi gets turned off by accident or it reboots, it'll start the motion soft at the beginning. So type in sudo nano /etc/default/motion, and then in this file you can set motion daemon to yes. By default it's no if you don't want it to start at boot up, but if you do want it to start at boot, which I do, type in yes and hit Control X to exit and Y to save. Now type in sudo reboot, and when your Pi starts back up again, you should see the little light on your webcam light up, signaling that it's receiving video. Then if you go to any computer on your network and you go into a web browser and type in the IP address and then :8081, which is the default port, you should see an image of what the Raspberry Pi is seeing. So this is the security footage that you'll be receiving. There's a timestamp at the bottom, and I have it running at 30 frames per second, so pretty smooth. So now that you've got your security cam footage working, you're going to want to have to disguise your security cam. I definitely went the cheap route, found just a little box, cardboard box, did some very precise measuring with a quarter and a Sharpie pen. I'm sure there's going to be plenty of people who can disguise their security cameras better, but since I was just doing a quick and dirty project, it's not so bad. And here, to protect the no-hole, there's a bunch of boxes outside, so I was able to kind of disguise it with a bunch of other boxes. And here you can see the security cam is all set up. I've got stashed away up on top of some boxes, and now I can see Burke's trying to sneak up on me while I'm working in the no-hole. In the future, I'll do some more digging into the configuration file to set up motion to trigger and send me an email alert or save the photo if it sees motion. But for the time being, this is just a simple, quick way of getting the security cam up and running.
So that wasn't as complicated as I thought it was.
No, it's not too bad. All the motion software that you basically have to set up is just tweak a couple of those settings, but it's plug and play now with the USB camera and everything.
And I have to say, because I played with the motion package a long, long time ago, it is very much matured. I just recently looked at it again. I'm like, oh, okay, they fixed a lot of the things that people didn't like about it.
Yes, and the nice thing is it doesn't take a lot of work to get it set up, but if you want to get super granular and like get into the nitty-gritty with some of the settings, all of that is still available.
Right. And, you know, one of the other nice things about that kind of a package is you can use as many or as few of the features as you want. If you just want it to be a camera that you can access over the internet, that's very easy to do.
Right.
But then you go ahead and you add in, like, okay, the motion zones, and I want to do motion detection here and here.
Right.
That's when you can really kind of geek out.
Yeah.
I will say, the first time I played with this, I would mess up the configuration. And I couldn't get it back, so I would just end up doing a reinstallation of everything.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm glad that that's not such a problem anymore.
No, I haven't had that issue at all. It's been pretty easy to work with. The only thing I wish it had is smell-o-vision, because I'm sure it would smell Burke before it would see it.
Indeed.
He's going to kill me.
You know, Brian, it's kind of amazing to think how much we've grown over the course of a year. I mean, because 2016 was the time that we went to two episodes. So it was harder because we had more content, but it also gave us the opportunity to kind of ratchet up our game because we had the sort of the build heavy day and then the kind of the DIY heavy day.
Yeah, and I think my favorite part of the whole change that we've done in 2016 is that we'll focus on one thing for an episode. So we really get to do deep dives into Arduino and playing with LEDs or whatever that project is for that episode.
Yeah, and it made it a lot easier for people to actually find the material because it used to be, this was the old style of Noah, actually.
Noah
2.0, because Noah 1.0 was when it was still Leo and Iaz. Mm-hmm. Noah 2.0 was when it was Iaz, myself, and then you. And then we moved to the 3.0, which was sort of like, hey, you know what? If we're going to be talking about something, let's talk about it for all three segments to make it easier for people to find these segments later on. Because that's been a big complaint from the know-it-alls.
The Kitas. But I think, judging by what we've just seen, we've had a good time.
And I think so.
People have watched and enjoyed it as well.
And, I mean, let's be honest. We get paid to mess around with tech.
Which is the best part.
Yeah.
Which is the best part.
Thank you. Speaking of thank you, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode of Know How. You know, if you're like me, you probably don't have a lot of time for anything that's not related to technology. Or in my case, I do have another job. But there's a thing that we should be doing. We should be watching how we eat. It is so important not to go back to that fast food restaurant day after day after day. It's so important for us to have some sort of variety in the food that we put into our bodies. It is so important to make sure that what we're eating is fresh and good for us. But we don't get a lot of time to do it, which is why I'm so happy to have Blue Apron as a sponsor of Know How. Blue Apron is the best way to make sure that you get that variety, that you get that healthy food, that you get easy to make meals that you can do yourself. I mean, if you are a DIYer, if you are a maker, why not make your food? Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with fresh, high quality ingredients. In fact, the number one fresh ingredient delivery place in the world. And everything is pre-portioned and pre-measured so that all you have to do is follow a recipe card and you can prepare your meal in 40 minutes or less. You can save time and money. Shopping at the grocery store is 60% more expensive than Blue Apron. So not only are you going to have it more conveniently, but it's going to, do a much smaller hit on your wallet. Now, if you spend a lot of time eating out or at high-end grocery chains, you can now spend under $10 per person for healthy home-cooked meals. You can customize your recipes each week based on your dietary preferences, and you choose a delivery option that fits your needs. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. They deliver to 99% of the continental United States, and they set the highest quality standards for the community of 150-plus local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. Blue Apron not only supports a more sustainable food system, but it supports happy and healthy families. Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly three times more often. Folks, this is not just something that you buy. This is not something that you just get. This is something that you experience. Blue Apron wants to make you a fan of the cooking experience, and you can do it today because you are members of the Twiet Riot, of the know-it-alls, of the Twit Army for a fraction of the price. Right now, you can get new recipes each week by Blue Apron's culinary team that are not going to be repeated, including things like Jamaican-style vegetable turnovers with marinated orange salad, spicy shrimp and Korean rice cakes with cabbage and furikake, I think that's how we say it, baked mozzarella chicken, oh my goodness, with yellow tomato sauce, kale, and fettuccine pasta, and seared pork chops with farro, Brussels sprouts, and cranberry chutney. If any of that sounds appetizing, if any of that sounds like something that you might want to try, then you owe it to yourself to try Blue Apron. You can check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And we thank Blue Apron for their support of Know How. Hey, Brian, what about it? You think maybe we should get back to the action, the best of 2016?
Yeah, I'm sure people are on the edge of their seats waiting for more of that best of action.
Well, folks, let's get to it. The best of the best in the second half of 2016. All this is a motor with a gearbox connected to the shaft and some sort of potentiometer. Now, we know from
our Project Arduino that a potentiometer can just vary the amount of resistance that it's giving to any given line. In this particular case, we use it to vary the amount of voltage that goes back into the Arduino so that we can set a certain value to it, right?
Right.
That's what we've done in the past. What this will do is this will allow us to do the same thing. I'm actually going to demonstrate it. I've got the servo, I've got a servo tester, and I've got a power supply. This is the standard universal battery eliminator circuit that we've been playing with for a while. So let me go ahead and hook this up. Positive, negative, give it some power. Okay, now as I turn this, you can hear the sound.
So if we had like a little propeller or something on there, you'd see it turn.
Yeah, actually, I think I have something. I'm pretty sure. Yes, there. This will make it visible, so you can actually see it on camera. I have the ability to change the value of this potentiometer, which is then encoded onto that servo.
Right.
Wow, focus is going all the way down there. Okay. So this is why we use this kind of technology. This is PWM. We use this for positioning things on, say, our quadcopter when we want to control the throttles.
Right.
And it is pretty exact. But once I start getting up from this base model, I do get kind of expensive, I do get kind of heavy, and I do get kind of complicated because this is a complicated servo mechanism. You do have that motor, you do have all those gears, and then you also have that potentiometer that gives me a little bit of feedback control.
Okay. Okay. So now, what's a stepper motor?
Let's look at a stepper motor. A stepper motor looks like this. This is actually one of the most basic stepper motors that you can get. We're going to talk about the model in just a bit. This, along with its driver, and we're going to explain why we need a driver in just a bit, costs less than $2 on eBay. I bought like a box of 10 of these for like $17. It was ridiculous. It was fantastic. Now, they are far, far less complicated than a servo. So a servo is a motor that uses a few poles, say 4 to 12, whereas a stepper motor can use 50 to 100 plus poles. And the reason why that's going to be important is because it allows me to have fine control over where the motor stops inside its rotational range.
Okay, so when you say pole, that's the amount that it moves?
Well, like the number of windings, the number of magnets that it has. So imagine this, on a servo motor, the motor rotates a potentiometer, and then that value will let the servo know when it's supposed to stop.
Okay, right.
On a stepper motor, because there are so many poles, the motor naturally wants to stop along certain spots in its rotation, right? If you've ever played with a motor, you notice that sometimes it's easier to turn, sometimes it's harder to turn.
Right.
It's flipping between poles.
Okay.
Well, if you have more poles, you have more places where the motor wants to stop.
That makes sense. Okay.
So what I can do with a stepper motor is I can have much of the same fine positional control, but I get it in a much less expensive package. In one that can provide way, way more torque, and one that is, well, it's a lot less expensive to drive.
Is it more reliable? Like, is there a chance that it would last longer than if you're going to use a servo for certain projects?
Yes, and primarily because a servo motor will use a complicated gearbox with that potentiometer. Anything in there can jam. If the potentiometer breaks, it doesn't work.
Right.
One of the gears break, it doesn't work. If the motor starts to go out, it doesn't work. Stepper motors are pretty... they're big, dumb devices.
Okay.
And as long as you pulse power to them the right way, they'll go ahead and rotate.
Cool.
Okay. Now, let's go ahead and go down a few of the things that you'll want to know. If you are considering either a stepper motor or a servo motor for your project, a stepper motor, you're going to want to use it when you have a lot of torque necessary. So if you have something that it's heavy and it needs to be rotated.
Like a door hinge
or something? A door, a hinge, right. Stepper motors are much better because they have way more low-end torque.
Okay.
Versus servo motors. Servo motors actually have more torque once they hit the top of their speed range. So, I mean, consider that. It's sort of like comparing a gas engine and an electric engine. You need to choose the right one for the application that you're doing.
Okay.
The other thing to remember is, of course, a stepper motor is less complicated. It doesn't have a potentiometer normally it doesn't have a potentiometer like a servo.
Right.
But it does require a driver board. Whereas the servo, I'm running it off of 5 volts and a digital signal.
Yeah.
You're going to see in a bit, it takes a bit more to run a stepper.
Okay, yeah, because we've got this little... This is the driver board you're talking about?
Right, that's a driver board. So we can't just plug this straight into our Arduino. First of all, that's not enough power. Secondly, we need this. This is the logic that will help me translate pulses from the Arduino into something the stepper motor should actually do.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Now, this is important.
when we've been dealing with two-phase motors, like the DC motor we had in our project lunchbox, very simple. You provide power in one direction, it rotates one direction. You switch that power, it rotates the other direction.
Yeah.
The three-phase engines that we've been using on our quadcopters, it's a little bit more complicated because now you have three phases, you have three poles that you're playing with.
Mm-hmm.
But the the electronic speed controller automatically does all the switching for you.
Okay.
With a stepper motor, you'll notice, Alex, if you go to the overhead here, there's actually five wires coming out of this, and one of them is ground, but the other four are the four phases of this motor. And the way that I rotate this is that I don't just apply power to it. I have to pulse signal. I have to pulse the power in a certain
pattern,
in order to make this rotate from step to step to step to step.
Okay, because each step, is it just little magnets that it's
Yeah, well, and we'll say that in just a bit. Okay, so now this is a 28BYJ-48 motor, and this is a ULN 2003 driver board. Alex, I have a link here. You can get these on eBay. In fact, this is not even the cheapest. I found them on eBay. Go ahead and buy yourself a bunch of these because they're great to test with. They're very easy to set up, and they're cheap. I like cheap.
Yeah, $2 for one?
Cheap is muy, muy good. Now, go ahead and show that the image that I put in there, Alex, because that's going to show them how a one of these works. There's some important specs. Leave this up. First of all, they'll leave it up. There. Go back to the picture that we had. There we go. So we've got a couple of pieces of information that we can take from this. First of all, it is a 5-volt motor, which is good because that means that I'm going to be able to power it using the same 5-volt power source I'm using for my Arduino. I know that it's 4-phase. I know, and now this is important, the stride angle is 5.625 and the speed variation ratio is 1 to 64. What that tells me is that every time this motor steps, it's rotating 5.625 degrees of the 360 degrees around the shaft.
Okay.
So every pulse moves the motor that much. However, the modifier of this is the speed variation ratio. It's going through a small gearbox. That means that the motor needs to turn 64 times.
To do a full 360?
To do a full 360 of the shaft on the outside of the casing.
Okay.
Now, there's a little bit of math here. But that stride angle of 5.625 gives us 64 steps. It's 360 divided by 5.625.
Mm-hmm.
64 steps for the motor to rotate fully. But because it's geared down 64 times, we have to multiply that by 64, which is going to give us 4,096. So in order for this motor to turn the shaft on the outside of the casing 360 degrees, it needs to step 4,096 times.
Okay. Now that adds up. That makes sense. And that's what you're going to be that's what the driver board's programmed to do?
Well, that's what we're going to program the Arduino to do.
Okay.
But just remember, in order for this motor to make it all there's the motor and then there's the shaft.
There's the shaft, right.
So in order for that shaft on the outside to make it all the way around 360 degrees, that motor has to be pulsed 4,096 times.
Got it. And if you wanted to do half, if you wanted to do a 180, you would do half that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You want to go, and then actually it's kind of binary down from the 1056 or 1028 and so on and so forth.
Cool.
So what does this mean? This means that we can build an application using an Arduino where the Arduino can automatically go one full rotation this way by going 4,096 pulses, and then we're going to reverse rotation and make it go one full revolution the other way. And this will allow us to demonstrate the basic principle of using a stepper motor with an Arduino.
No, that's really cool. And like, if you're going to be doing that for the chicken coop idea where you open and close the door, you could set that on a timer to do, you know, this much of a rotation at this time, and then at the end of the day when the sun's setting, close the door.
Precisely. All right, so let's do it. Let's go ahead and do some building. A few of the things that we're going to need, if you go to the overhead, Alex, we are going to need this. So we've got our stepper motor and our driver. Again, this is the 8B motor, and this is a 2003 driver board. This will give me a place to put power, a place to plug in my motor, and then pins to connect to my Arduino. I'm also going to need my Arduino of choice. Again, I'm using the Uno just because this is sort of our demonstration model. It has a breadboard that we're not really going to need, along with some potentiometers. I can run this on any Uno. This is actually very simple code. So if you have a Uno Nano, if you have a Micro, if a Pro.
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Just know where your pins are. Mm-hmm. I'm also going to need a 5-volt power supply. I got this here. This is the UBEC that we've been using for so many different projects.
Right. So you can draw power from
pretty much anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. This will take it all the way from, I think, 7.4 volts up to 30 volts. So any of that will give me nice, clean 5-volt power out of here.
Cool.
Okay. I'm also going to need some jumpers because I need to be able to connect this to this. All right. So this is the first project where I'm going to ask everyone to separate power supplies. In the past, we've been running like our LED lights mm-hmm. off of the internal power source of the Arduino. And we can kind of get away with that. Stepper motors, you really don't want to do that because what will happen is if it gets bogged down, mm-hmm. like if there's too much force being exerted against the rotation of the shaft, it will jump its power consumption and it could jump it past the point that the Arduino could supply and then you end up...
Oh, blowing a little fuse on the Arduino?
Well, blue smoke in the Arduino. Okay. So we're going to have a separate power supply for the motor and the driver board than we do from the Arduino. The Arduino's being powered off my computer right now. But this the stepper motor is going to be
on the battery
off of this, right?
Cool.
So if you go to the side view, I think the side view has a tighter shot. There we go. So the first thing we want to do is we want to locate this. This little row of pins right here, that's the switch. So this little, if you could digital zoom on that, Alex, if right here, this is a jumper that tells the board whether or not it's going to be on. So right now it's set to on, but I also could connect this to an external power switch if I wanted the ability to turn this on and off, right?
Okay.
This is where I put power, and I don't know if you could see, but I've got positive on the inside, and I've got ground on the outside. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go ahead and hook that up now. Positive on the inside, ground on the outside.
This is 5 to 12 volts on there.
Right. There we go. So I'm going to give it 5 volts. I also need to hook my motor up. Now, this one's easy. There's only one plug where the motor plug will connect to.
It has little guides, yeah.
Yeah. Now, what I need to do is I need to connect this to my Arduino. There are 4 pins here, and I actually need all 4. I'm going to show you why I need all 4 in a bit. I'm going to take this length of lead. I'm just going to make sure I'm going black, white, gray, and then purple. Okay. So that will be my 1, 2, 3, 4. These are labeled IN1, IN2, IN3, and IN4.
Okay.
Let's see if I can get that into the camera. There we go.
There you are.
Okay. So I'm just going to do this. Like.
Easy does it. Easy.
Stay on target.
There are 4 wires.
There are 4. Now what I need to do is I need to connect it to my Arduino. I'm going to go ahead and disconnect this power for a second. Now, you have a bunch of pins, depending on which Arduino you're using. I go to the side view again, Alex. Here, if you do the digital zoom, Alex, please, you'll see you've got all the way from 1 up to 13. So on this Uno, I've got 13 digital pins that I can play with.
Right.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and put it here. I'm going to put it in the upper range of the register. Upper range of the register. So I'm going to put it 8, 9, 10, and 11.
Okay.
All right. So I'm going to do this.
8,
so
9, 10.
So pin 1, which was the black one, is going to be 8. And pin 4, which was the purple one, is going to be 11.
And all 4 of these pins, are they just to send the signal to tell the stepper motor which direction to move?
Right. So each of these has the ability to pulse to the driver board, mm-hmm. which will then tell the stepper motor which way it's supposed to be turning.
So then it's deciphered by the controller on here?
The controller is really just passing it on.
Because
the driver board is designed so that you can power it from an external logic. But this is doing all the logic. And we're actually going to show you the programming. You'll see the logic that's necessary to make this thing turn.
Okay.
So I'm going to go ahead and power up, and hopefully I don't get blue smoke.
You shouldn't, right? Okay.
Which is good. So this is what I want. The driver board is powered up, because I know that because I see it's supplying power through the UBEC.
Right.
But I'm getting no lights. And the reason why I'm getting no lights is because I'm not yet receiving any signal from this Arduino.
Okay.
Now, I have pre-programmed this Arduino, but I pre-programmed it incorrectly. I'm going to show you in just a bit.
For demonstration purposes?
For demonstration purposes.
Okay.
There we go. And if you go ahead and go over to my 11 really quickly, we're going to show them some quick programming. You'll notice that I have here IN 1, 2, 3, and 4. So I've created these variables to take in or to push out bits to those four pins I connected between the driver board and the Arduino, right?
Right.
And those numbers correspond
to the pins?
To the pin on the Arduino, but I did not connect it to 4, 5, 6, 7. What did I connect it to?
You did 8, 9, 10, and 11.
So that's what I have to change it to. So let's go ahead and change this. IN1 is connected to 8. IN2 is connected to 9. IN3 is connected to 10. Mm-hmm. And IN4 is connected to
11.
All right. So now if I upload this,
should the lights come on the driver board then?
You'll see it in just a bit. It's going
to...
see. Now, if you move your hand so
that you
can see. There you go. So you'll see that these lights are pulsing, and that's because the Arduino is sending pulse signals to this, and this motor is actually turning. You can't see it because it doesn't have anything on it, but let me do this. There. So you can see this is slowly turning this stepper motor.
Yeah. And it looks like it's getting to a certain point and then bouncing back?
Right. So I have this code set to do about 360 degrees and then bounce back. So there's a couple of things here that we need to know. You can change this, of course, but I tried to make the code as flexible as possible. The first part is the data pin. Mm-hmm. Just like it sounds, and just like we did before, that's the pin on the Arduino that I need to connect to the digital in on the WS2812 strip.
Right.
So that's the one that's going to be pushing that array of bytes out to the strip. Mm-hmm. That's where it's going to come from. The second number you have to take a look at there is pot pin. So this is the pin, the analog pin, that it's going to be looking at for the voltage coming off of the wiper on the potentiometer. That's
right.
And actually, Alex, if you go to the side here, you'll see there's three. You see there's three positions, 1, 2, 3.
Because
so positive, negative, or either way, it doesn't matter.
Right.
That center pin is connected to the wiper, and that will change voltage between between zero and whatever the positive is.
And that's the range.
And that gives me my range. Okay. So let's go back to the code. That gives me my analog pin and my digital pin. The next part you don't have to change at all, WS2812. You might use WS2811s or 2812Bs, but it will work with WS2812.
So you would just have to change the number then. And,
The model number. But the next one you're probably going to have to play with is this, 32. So this is still currently set for our steampunk goggles,
right?
Which only had 32 LEDs. We have 150 LEDs here.
So just 150.
Just change it to 150. Right. And down below is brightness and frames per second. You can play with this. I like to keep it at 100% brightness. Mm-hmm. If I was going to add the second potentiometer to allow me to change brightness, I would actually make this a variable instead rather than a hard-coded number.
Right. Yeah, right. A variable that would then set a loop for checking what the potentiometer is at, like,
right,
setting-wise.
Just like I did for the digital assignment, mm-hmm, for the animation, I would just have a function that checks it, looks at it, makes a range for it, and then lets me set brightness according to it.
Cool.
Yeah. And actually, I'll show you what that looks like down below, because I'm not going to do that on the show. That's your homework. You're going to take that home and play with brightness.
Actually, that's the project I want to do. I want to set that up in my kitchen and be able to change the brightness and also change what pattern or color it's using.
Can I tell you a secret?
What?
We're doing this question because you asked about that.
See, it's partially my project.
It's bro love,
too,
man. It's bro love.
Boom.
Boom. All right. Let's get to business. So we know that we need to hook up our breadboard so that we're using this potentiometer. We know that we need to get data pin off of 7.
Right.
We know that we have to get analog in on 0.
Zero.
And we know we need to get this thing voltage somehow, which is actually just going to come from the USB cable. So let's do it.
Cool.
First thing we're going to do is let's get power to the potentiometer, because we need to be able to give it power from the Arduino so that it can give us a signal back that then gets converted into some sort of value. So remember power, I'm going to take it from ground and voltage in, which gives me unregulated power. And it doesn't matter which side I put it on. I could have positive and negative or positive and negative.
Right.
Yeah. So
Okay,
so I'm going to go like that.
And just to refresh,
like
the way
that
breadboards work is that one line is the...
Precisely. Where is it? These are connected to those. That whole line is connected. It's just a piece of metal underneath. All right, so I need to get this. This is the wiper. So that's the value that's going to change. When I change this potentiometer, it's going to give me a value between 0 and 5.
And that's the pin. We're going to be setting this to pin zero?
Correct. Analog zero, which is right there. So now I have a way to power the potentiometer, and I also have a way to get the value back from the potentiometer so it knows where it's going to get the value to set the animation.
Cool.
All right. Now let's go back to our code here. We've got our potentiometer taken care of, but we need data pin 7 connected to the digital in on the LEDs. So let's do this.
So do we have to cut some wires?
I'm not going to cut. I would.
Oh, you can just use the pin.
I'm going to be lazy and use jumpers.
Well, it's better to test that way anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So what I have is this. This is my digital input. Remember, I said the green one was digital in. So I'm just going to put this jumper in there. It's kind of ghetto.
Yeah.
This is not a permanent installation. Please don't do this.
And leave it.
Just
put some electrical tape on it.
That's such a bad idea because all it takes is like it gets pulled and suddenly that piece of metal is contacting something else in the project box.
Yeah.
That's a bad thing. All right. So this goes to where?
Zero.
Well, no. We got
seven. Seven.
Yeah, exactly. So digital pin 7, which is right.
It's on the other side.
There. Yeah. Okay. So now I've got digital going in, but I need a ground here.
Why do you need a ground there?
Well, because this ground is isolated from that ground.
Oh, okay.
Right.
So
what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and the ground is white.
And then
I'm just going to add it to any ground on this board.
Because there's a ground there.
Yep. So we're going to put one right there.
Okay, cool.
There we go. Okay, so this gives me an almost complete installation for this. I have a way to get power to the potentiometer. I have a way to get the value back from the potentiometer into the Arduino. I have a way to get the digital out into the digital in of the WS2812 strip.
Now you just need power to the strip.
Power!
You gotta have power!
Power, you bozo! Okay, so we're using this. This is a UBEC that I've already set for 5 volts. There is a jumper on the back here. There we go. So I can move this from there to there and get it to 6 volts.
Okay.
So just read the instructions. Make sure you've got it set for 5 volts. In fact, what I would do is if you've got a multimeter, and you really should have a multimeter if you're doing this.
Where's our multimeter?
Test it just to make sure. Because some of these actually have really poorly silkscreened instructions on them.
Okay.
Sorry about that. But yeah, it's true. All right. So I'm going to be cheap. I should go ahead and cut these and solder them. But
I'm guessing you're going to use jumpers.
I'm just going to put them straight in.
Okay.
How about that? So white right here is ground.
Okay.
So, and again, please don't do this in the real world because I swear.
This is for testing purposes. This is to make sure that everything's working properly. You know? But don't leave it like this.
Oh, this is, there's so much potential for bad things to happen right now.
Should I stand back for a little while?
Well, I mean, we don't have power applied, but...
Yeah, okay. But we will.
Here we go. Just don't breathe.
Because if those two wires crossed...
We have a problem. Houston, we will have issues. Okay, so let's go ahead and give power to this Arduino.
Easy there.
Just be really careful. Just don't move it too much. Okay. And now we have... we're going to power it off of this battery.
So have you updated the software on the Arduino from? Have you sent the new parameters to it?
I have, and we will look at the software in just a bit. So let's go ahead and boop. There we go. So if you bring the lights down a little bit.
Ooh. Pretty.
All right. So this potentiometer, when I turn it, it actually changes the animation of the entire strip.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, so let's go from that to all the way this way.
Spiral. That's cool.
Ooh. And all the way the other way. Off.
That's the fade. The fade to black.
Yeah.
That's cool.
But I do not yet have the white loaded up on this.
Right. Because I'm guessing this is the same profile you had for the goggles. So you haven't touched any of the...
Actually, look at this one. This one's cool.
It looks cool.
Actually, it's kind of cool in a spiral because it does that circular thing.
Yeah.
It's got the whole disc of Tron thing going on.
That's really
neat. That gives me a good idea for some cosplay stuff.
Tron disc.
Okay, so,
Sorry. Distracted by LEDs again.
Mesmerized. Sorry about that. But we want to show you what we were talking about, where you can supply power to this at multiple points.
Mm-hmm.
Because this isn't an issue. Since it's only 150 LEDs, I'm not even coming close to stressing
right.
this UBEC.
Right.
But if I was running a 300 LED string, I wouldn't want to run it off of one.
Would you have just one connected to the other side?
I would have one connected to the other side. Because if I ran it off of single one, it would probably work most of the time. But mm-hmm. if I ever cranked it to like full bright white, I am now over-amping my UBEC, and I'm probably going to blow it up.
Okay.
I mean, not immediately, but probably at a really inconvenient time. That's
right, when you're showing all your friends and family. And
exactly.
Look at my project.
Merry Christmas. We burned the house down. All right, so this is just another... Remember this? We created this a while back. This was my Arduino in a case. So I have a UBEC in here that is actually supplying power both to an external source and to the Arduino. It's got a filter in here located right there, which gives me clean power to the Arduino. So no matter what's happening on the outside link, I'm still getting nice, clean, consistent 5-volt power to the Arduino.
Cool.
I'm only going to use this. I'm not using the internal Arduino. I'm only using this as a second UBEC because, again, I'm lazy and I didn't want to solder another one. But we're going to do the same thing. We're going to connect black here. So this is ground.
Which is white to black.
Which is white to black. Because you know what? We're all the same color, really.
That's true. I don't see color, Padre.
Yeah. I'm glad Tay wasn't helping me to solder these together. Oh, poor racist Tay.
That AI never had a chance.
It didn't. You can't put that on the internet. We're going to mess with it. That's how that works. Okay. There we go.
Easy now.
Oh, gosh.
Don't
wait,
cross
I have the other
the
one.
Street.
I have the other one unplugged, right?
What do you mean, another one plugged?
The other power source? Okay.
Oh.
Wow, that is super jank, but okay, let's plug it in. Okay.
I might stand back
this is
a little
so
bit.
Not good. Okay, it's hold on. I'm not making enough contact here. I don't want to do this, Brian.
Yeah, I'll stand over here. It's okay.
The problem is that it won't go in. It's like just touching. What I probably should have done is solder these.
That would have taken time.
That would have taken time, but you know what? For our audience, don't you think they deserve it, Brian?
They do deserve the chance of us hurting ourselves on camera.
Well, now that you put it that way, actually, you know what I could do? I'm just going to take it off the internal breadboard. Yeah, how about that?
Oh, yeah. Getting crafty.
That's what I do. I didn't put an internal breadboard. I took it out of the last revision.
Okay.
See, I was too clever for myself. Tell me not to touch that, please, because I don't want to disrupt that. Because when I plug it in,
it looks like it'll be okay.
It will do very bad things. Mm-hmm. Okay. Ooh, that one's in.
Okay.
Ah-ha-ha.
Ground in.
I have you now, electronics. Okay. Let's see. Did I get close enough?
Cursed by our own hubris. Oh, don't touch them while it's plugged in. It makes me nervous.
It's gonna explode. Okay, all right, and then I should be able to get this one at the same time, and it should light up. And, oh, I've lost the digital. Okay, oh, here we go. Yes, we're good.
We are good? Oh, right, you're going to twist the knob.
Okay.
Okay.
Phew. For a second there, I thought I was about to blue smoke it. All right, so bring the lights down. All right, you'll notice, so I've got a power supply here, and I've got a power supply here, so I'm going to connect this one. I've now got two power supplies giving power from either direction.
And they're both going through the UBEC?
No, well, they have independent UBECs. So there's a UBEC in here.
Okay.
Two different power supplies. Now, I could be running a 12-volt line between them, or I could just be using two different adapters.
Okay.
I could have like a 19-volt adapter and a 12-volt adapter, and each UBEC would be supplying power. Here's the cool thing, though. The LEDs, because of how resistance works, they're automatically going to draw from the UBEC that's closest to them.
Okay.
That's just how, well, I mean, more or less, it's not exact because the resistance will vary through the string. But it does mean that each UBEC is only going to have to do part of the work. And the way we know that is, look, I can disconnect this one and it still goes.
All right.
And I can disconnect this one.
Careful. Don't touch the wires.
And it still goes.
Ah, cool.
Right?
Cool.
So that's what we're looking for. This is the kind of redundancy that you can build into your system if you have multiple power points.
Right.
All right. Brian, whenever we talk about fiber,
oh,
I always get people with that glassy look, the glazed look, because they're
Like the face is going to start melting off?
The face melting. Whenever I try to describe the difference between single mode and multi-mode.
Let's do it. Give me the face melt.
It's important. Okay. So we talked a little bit about this. When you're talking about single mode, so that's all this orange stuff.
Okay.
This
always color-coded like that?
It's pretty typical. Multi-mode will typically be orange. Single mode will typically be yellow.
Okay.
Not always, but most of the time. In this use case. All right. This will go 550 meters, which sounds like a long way. That's, 1,800 feet.
That's enough for our project.
It's enough for our project. But there's a different kind of fiber, and that's this. This is called single mode.
Right.
Now, single mode actually goes far, far longer. You're talking about 550 meters, so half a kilometer for the multi-mode. This will do 15 standing on its head.
Wow.
Yeah, and people look at it and they go, but, okay, so is it the color that makes it go longer? What's the difference?
It looks a little thicker.
It is a little thicker, but that's the multi-mode is thicker. And so people are like, well, shouldn't that be able to carry more? Yes.
Uh-huh.
And no.
All right, Padre. Give me the details. Why?
Right. Here are the deets. When we're talking about multi-mode, we're talking about the typical constructions would be, let's see, what is that? 50-125 or 62.5-125. Those are measured in microns. And what those numbers mean is how big is the core versus how big is the cladding.
What is a cladding?
No, we'll see. Inside here, if you... Okay. So here,
let's get our microscopes out.
I know, exactly. The core is... That's not actually the core. Those white things?
Right.
That's the cladding that contains the core. It's only 50 to 62.5 microns. It's incredibly, incredibly small. The rest of this is just armor. It's a way to keep the fiber from getting pinched or damaged or whatever.
Right. It's like any wire that has the rubber coating around it, right?
Right, exactly. But even though it looks really, really small, the thing is 50 or 62.5 microns is actually really big when you're talking about light.
When you're talking, like photons of light?
Exactly. Okay. So what will happen inside of a multi-mode fiber is the light will actually bounce around the inside of the core.
Okay.
Because every time it hits, like, the edge of the core and gets to the cladding, it will want to bounce in the other direction.
Bounce around.
Now, that means... I can actually, as an IT engineer, I can actually use that phenomenon to push more data through. I can what they've mastered with multimode is you use different lasers on the same fiber that are running at different angles, and they're running at different spins for light, and you can actually have that all go through the same fiber at the same time. I can push easily 40 to 100 gigabits. Per second through one of these things.
Okay. And then, so I'm just guessing it's the single, the yellow one, this is just a smaller space for light to
pass through? It's a smaller space of light. You can only do one mode, only one beam at a time. Now, this means I can carry less data with a single mode cable than I can with a multi-mode cable, but it also means with multi-mode, with that light bouncing around, you eventually get to a point where... It's all become gibberish.
Okay, the way I'm trying to comprehend it in my mind is if there's like a 4-lane highway and there's all the traffic is crisscrossing and trying to get all to the same point, like at a certain distance, all the cars just start running into each other. Is that kind of what's happening?
It's kind of what's happening. In fact, you know, I just realized we shouldn't have turned this thing over.
Because we should draw this out.
We should draw this out. We should
really
show
push Padre's art to the limit.
I know. What art? do art. I do PowerPoint, folks. It's different. All right, so let's get rid of my really expertly drawn drawing
house
of his
and
house
man cave, which is a circle.
Yes, let's get rid of that. And instead, let's look at what... let's start with a multi-mode fiber. So a multi-mode fiber might look like this. So here's the outside cable that just protects it. Mm-hmm. And then you've got your cladding. And the cladding is a layer inside that kind of contains the core. And then you've got, so this is all.
So that's the plastic that's protecting it.
Right. And then the core is like that. It's actually really, really small.
Wait, so there's something in between.
I know this is.
Another insulating layer?
Yeah, that's the cladding. So you've got the cladding. So the only thing that's active is this core inside. And in a multi-mode fiber, what's happening is the light is bouncing around like this.
Right.
It just keeps bouncing back and forth, bouncing back and forth. And I can actually use that to take multiple paths of light,
right,
which will be recombined at the other side, which I can then, I can use to push more data, right?
Right.
Single mode. So this is 50 to 62.5 microns diameter, uh-huh, this core. Single mode is about 9 microns. So it's much, much smaller. So it looks kind of the same. You've got your outer core. You've got your cladding. But then the core itself is basically just that. It's one single line. There is no ability for signals to bounce around. You only have one going down at any given time. So you're not going to get that crosstalk. You're not going to get that mush. You're not, well, that's, by the way, this is a horrible, horrible drawing. You're not going to get any of the signal degradation effects that you get so quickly in multimode.
Okay. So, and can you send and receive data through at the same time on both of those?
No. Or? So that's why if you look at this, every fiber pair is a pair. One is transmit, one is receive.
You can't. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
I mean, you could do it, but then it would be half duplex. Either it would be sending or receiving, not both. This way I can send and receive at the same time.
Okay.
Okay. Now, people get kind of confused by this explanation, so I've got a really easy way to demonstrate it. And actually, I've showed this off on the show before, but it's been a while, so I thought we should do it again.
Sure.
This is just a laser. It's a network. It's an IT laser for enterprise, which means it costs a ridiculous amount of money, but I could just do this with a laser pen. I'm going to hook this up to the multimode, like so. What I'm doing is I'm shooting light into here.
Oh,
if you go ahead and drop the lights a little bit, Alex, and then go to the overhead or go to the side view. There we go. So I've got that, right?
Yeah.
So that's the laser going through the fiber onto the paper.
That's cool.
Okay. Now, go back to that shot, Alex. Now, look what happens. What I'm going to do is I'm going to, like, move the fiber. I'm going to crumple the fiber a little bit. See how that changes?
Oh,
so
yeah.
What's happening is the shape of the cladding and the shape is actually changing, and it changes how the light looks.
Well, that's probably got to be bad for sending information across.
But I mean,
right?
It's used to it. I mean, this
it can.
Yeah, and then this, but it shows you that the light is bouncing back and forth inside of the cladding.
That's cool.
Okay? So let me show you what single mode looks like. We're going to do the exact same setup, same laser. But here we go. Now I'm going to go ahead and mess with this.
Yeah, like nothing, basically. It looks like it's moving like a fraction, but definitely doesn't look like...
You get a little bit off the edges, but it's not changing like the pattern. You get a coherent light.
Yeah.
See, that's what single mode does. So single mode only has one light wave going through at any given time, which is why it stays together for so much longer. This is why this can go 15 kilometers versus 500 meters for the other one.
Hmm. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. And that's actually something that you can play with. Anyone who wants to do a science project, if you want to impress people, go buy yourself a $40 laser diode. Make yourself, 3D print yourself an interface between this and a fiber optics cable. You can actually use this as a security sensor. This is what we did. We ran multimode fiber underneath a carpet.
Yeah.
And we had it connected to a camera, and the camera just looked for differences. If you step anywhere on that carpet and it touches a multimode, it changes how the light looks.
And that triggers it.
It triggers
that's
it. It was
awesome.
Actually, kind of
smart.
Fun. It was pretty cool.
Huh.
They also use this this phenomenon when they're troubleshooting networks because I can use what's called an OTDR, which will send a pulse of light down a fiber. And if there's a break, because of the way physics works, if light is going through a changed medium, mm-hmm, like a crack in the fiber, part of that energy actually bounces back.
Oh, so you get like talk back or something.
Yeah, so you send the pulse, and then when it comes back, you divide it by 2, and then you multiply that by the speed of light, and you know how far away the break is.
That makes sense. Wow. Okay, that's really cool.
Yay! So
I learned something
fun
today.
Fun with lasers, Brian.
Wow. Okay.
I know. Now, folks, this is fun because I like playing with fiber, but you know what we're really trying to do is to demystify this. There's a lot of people out there who they think they can work with Ethernet and they can't work with fiber because fiber is that's pro level. Not really. Get yourself some fiber gear. Learn how to network it. Learn how to use it because I find it to be one of the most useful things that you can do if you're a networking guy.
I would love to see how it's manufactured. Like, how do you make something that small and then wrap the coil around it and everything else?
There are actually elves Really small elves.
That's what you say for everything. Tiny little How elves. Do those quadcopters fly, Padre? It was elves. It was don't worry about it.
You know what keeps them in the air? Love. I learned that from
knew
Firefly.
It. Dang.
Okay.
It's true.
Brian, that does it for the best of 2016. You know, it was actually a hard choice because there were a lot of moments, but you did a really good job of finding the moments of moments.
That's what I dedicated myself to. This whole year, I've been saving the best things that we've done and just collecting them. You know?
Now, we should mention that we've got something a little special planned. You may notice on the schedule, a lot of our shows do a best of episode.
They do.
We actually did two.
We did do too, because we have so much content that is good and the things that we messed up too.
The next episode, the next best of episode is actually a best of the not as best stuff from Know How. One of the things that we really wanted people to realize is we mess up a lot.
It's part of the learning process, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And as you start to wire something together, you might then realize that you've done it completely backwards.
Or if you forget to put the heat shrink on before you actually solder wires together. Or you try to do something and it ends up not working or maybe bursting
or
into flames.
Leave LiPo batteries plugged in for too long and they get really puffy.
Or, especially on the episodes that you don't see on the live stream, it takes us 15 takes before we actually start the show because that's how we are.
That's the biggest one.
That really is. Now, we're going to be doing a special. It's a shorter episode, but the next best of is some of the things to give you hope that even us here at Know How, we sometimes don't have our stuff together.
That's right, right. So even like a beer copter, maybe?
Yep, and crashing a lot of those.
Yeah, things that just get destroyed, basically.
It's funny because we did get that one comment. Said, oh my gosh, I don't understand. You know, they do this in 15 minutes. And then I'm like, okay, you understand those 15 minutes were filmed like over 2 weeks, right?
Right.
And most of that was not highlights.
And then, like the 3D printers that finish in 30 seconds.
No, that's real speed.
Oh, that's totally real.
Yeah,
that's
totally real speed. Yeah, all my printers are fast.
Yeah.
How dare you?
You just pour cheetah blood on them and go faster.
Unicorn tears.
Oh, that too.
Yeah.
That too.
Anyways, if you want to find out more, please, 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 go to our show page. If you want to support Know How, this is how you spread it to your friends. Tell them to go to twit.tv/KH. What do they find there, Brian?
Well, if you go to twit.tv/KH, you'll not only find all the episodes from 2016, but 2015, 2014. I don't know if you'd want to go that far back, but you can also subscribe and download. And if there's ever a product or something that we talk about on the show, you're going to find it in the show notes there.
Yeah, and also, if you subscribe, you can get every episode automatically into your device of choice. And if you tell your friends to subscribe, it'll get into their device of choice, and it will help us to grow Know How. We are dedicated to making sure that TWiT always maintains a DIY maker community, and we can only do it with you.
Spread the knowledge.
And also, don't forget that we have a social media group on Google+. If you go to Google+ and look for Know How, there's an approval process because we did have a little problem.
You have to curate those things.
Well, we were getting cam girls and spam accounts.
Right. If you want that, you're going to have to go to a different community.
Go to a different community, yeah. But no, just go to Google+, look for Know How. We'll approve you. We'll get you right in, and you get access to over 10,000 Kitas. That's our know-it-alls, the people who do it every day. We love this thing that we call making, that we call DIYing. And it's a great place for you to pick up a project, to post pictures and videos of projects, and maybe to ask a couple of questions.
Definitely.
We know we've been really lax about doing Q&A.
Things have
feedback.
Ramped up for us at the end of the year here, so we've kind of fallen back on answering questions.
We haven't done it for like 4 months.
So maybe the beginning of next year then. 2017 feedback.
Yeah. Just go to Google+ and look for Know How. But that's not the only place to find us on the socials.
No, when you want to see how we prep for shows, how hard we work before we start a show, you'll want to follow us on Twitter. I think there's a few napping photos.
Thanks for that, by the way.
There's a balloon race that we did. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at @cranky_hippo.
And you're going to find me at twitter.com/PadreSJ. We also have a guest TD. Right now. I don't know if he's got his microphone on. He doesn't.
Probably not.
It's Lawrence. He has no camera, but you can follow. What's your Twitter, Lawrence?
Oh, it's Mobia, I think.
M-O-T-V-I.
Follow him at M-O-T-V-I. What?
M-O-T-B-I-A.
It works now. The mic works.
Yeah, do that.
M-O-T-B-I-A.
Yeah, follow him there.
You should. He's our dungeon master.
He is. He's the guy who kills everybody.
Yeah, with the nightmare hole.
Throws us into the nightmare hole. Until next time, I am Father Robert Balazar.
I'm Brian Burnett.
And now that you know how, go have a Merry Christmas.
Yeah, happy holidays.